Let's see. I know that everybody in this audience has already turned their cell phones off, so we don't have to talk about that, right? I probably haven't turned mine off. So, right, okay, good. So, hello, everybody. It's great to see you all here. I'm Sydney LeBlanc, the director of Uptown at Night, and I am super excited about this show tonight. I mean, what a great lineup we have. So wonderful to get this particular group of people tonight. So I'm really glad you're here. I think you'll really be in for a treat. And, of course, it's always so much fun to be back at the library. This is just a jewel of the city, as so many of you know. But if you don't know, this is the oldest library in the city. It was founded 265 years ago, and it has been revered by writers and by readers ever since. So, but the surprising thing is it also turns out to be a great place for a humor show. Who would have thought it? So it's really is just as far from a typical comedy club as you could imagine. But here we are, you know, in this wonderful parlor floor elegance of old New York. We have portraits and gilt frames on the wall. We have the fine china in the cabinets. And I don't know if you caught this, though, but we have no two-drink minimum. So, you know, we're cool there. We're cool there. So I'd like to thank Carolyn Waters, the head librarian, for inviting us back. Thank you, Carolyn. It's also hard to believe this is our sixth show at the library. So, yeah. Thank you, thank you. And thanks to Jenny Lawrence for her support for our shows all along. So anyway, we have a really special show tonight, as I said, and we're especially in tune with the library tonight because this is for the first time all of our humorists are also published authors. And you will find their books just outside the door, and I know they'll be happy to sign them for you after the show. So, I can also tell you that everyone in this lineup is very, very funny, but it's even better than that. They're smart funny, and I think that's the very best kind, and they will leave you tonight with lots of things to think about, and they will also leave you laughing. So, I hope you enjoy the show. And before we begin, let me introduce you to James Harvey, our keyboard player. He will be accompanying us tonight. So, okay, so, well, here we are in the ancestral home of prep. I mean, it doesn't get much more preppy than the Upper East Side. So we'll start tonight with Lisa Birnbach. And Lisa, as you all know, I'm sure, is the author of the official Preppy Handbook, which is the Bible for an entire generation, published 40 years ago, which is so hard to believe, still going strong. Since that time, Lisa has taken her talent for humor in lots of different directions. But tonight, she is going to give us her new take on the Upper East Side. This is going to be good, so listen up, everybody. Lisa.
I'm in the witness protection program now because I moved to the west side. Don't tell anybody. Yeah, that was my prop. This is my first time telling a story or not answering a question about Pima Cotton. So I thought I would tell a story that took place here on the Upper East Side because this is my motherland. This is where I grew up. This is where I was raised, you might say lowered. This is home. This is where I raised my three science experiments who've gone, you know, okay, not great. I have a dud. Two are good. And this is my spot. I used to live behind the Henry Moore that isn't there anymore. And that building was very nouveau. We know. I grew up in Carnegie Hill when it was called the DMZ. It was not chic, it was not gentrified, and in the afternoon you could smell the Rupert Brewery. Does anybody here remember that besides me and Danny and Diane and Rose and you? Okay, yeah, well, and in the 1960s when we were growing up in the 70s, it was like the 1950s or the 1940s. I went to a cloakroom to put on my bloomers. Anybody else? But I am going to tell you a story tonight that happened. Wait, let me just see. That happened a few blocks away from here. I would say it would be about a 2-minute walk or an $8 cab ride. And it happened in the early 2002, 2003, 2004, around there, when I was a, don't tell my mother, a newly separated woman. I was newly separated with 3 science experiments, and I was kind of adopted. Anybody here divorced? Okay, well, anybody not? You know how sometimes a well-meaning friend will adopt you when you're newly divorced, and they sort of want to take control of your life? And in my case, I was grateful for it because I was embarrassed, I was ashamed, I was sad, I was overwhelmed. And I got sort of adopted by a group of extremely rich women. And it's not nice to say rich, I know, but we're all friends here, and we're at the Society Library. Give me a break, we can do it. And these women were rich due to some very fortunate marriage situations. And one of them invited me to her birthday party. This birthday party took place, again, $8 or 2 minutes, your choice, away from here, pre-war Park Avenue duplex. And it was a birthday party. So, not knowing the birthday woman very well, I went to the store, and bought her a box of Crane stationery. Who doesn't need a box of Crane stationery? It works. You don't have to know the person well. A book could even be wrong. You never know. Stationery, you can't go wrong, right? Right. I buy her, I wrap it, I get to the party, and I see orange bags, if you know what I mean. I see, and I think you do, I see green and red bags, wink, wink. I saw that glossy burgundy of Asprey. I mean, I was in trouble. Cranes, schmanes. I mean, it was not going to work. Okay, so I was a little nervous about my small offering. But I thought, well, this is a birthday. It wasn't a big birthday. It wasn't a 5. It wasn't a 0. It wasn't a glorious golden moment. And she was still married. So I thought, you know, there's no problem. And to my horror, there was an opening ceremony. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So, it was like a baby shower. It was like a baby shower. It was like a bridal shower. It was like, yes, a nightmare, whoever said that. Or as we say in this neighborhood, a cauchemar, which is French, of course. So, we get to the and who brought me this? You know, it was really, yeah. And I said, apologetically, I didn't know you were registered a Pratese or something. I mean, it was bad. Did I say I live on the West Side now? Okay. Did I say that there are no subscriptions to Vogue on the West Side? Okay, all right, never mind. Anyway, so she opens my box of stationery. Nice stationery, but you know, it's not Pratese, and it's not Gucci, and it's not Hermes, and it's not Frette. I think she must have been registered, and I just didn't get the memo. And I felt that I had to compensate for this terrible, insulting piece of shit present I bought her. Pardon me. And so now the gift giving and trading and opening portion of the event is over, and I feel I've got to make up for it. Could I write her a check? No, that would be gauche. What can I do? Is this, okay. Is this okay? Okay. So, okay, I'm on my own. So what? I've been cut free by Sydney. So what can I do? And I think I'm going to tell a story because I have a really shocking story. So I tell the following true story. Some weeks earlier in the year, I'm going to say it's 2003-ish, I had gotten a text on my flip phone that said, in full, would you marry me? No, maybe, will you marry me? Will you? More optimistic. Will you marry me? And I thought, well, it must be a wrong number because my own husband won't speak to me. So, you know, I thought, it's a wrong number. I'm not going to look into it. But a few days later, I thought, oh, why not see what this is all about? Maybe somebody wants to marry me in the 404 Atlanta neighborhood. Maybe there's a person who has secretly loved me from Peachtree Road all these years. So I call the number. And this is the story I'm telling in lieu of a good present. And the person answers, a woman, and says hello. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, goodbye. I thought it was the wrong number. This is stupid. A day later, I get a phone call from a 718 number that I don't recognize. And a woman said, you call my girlfriend? And I didn't call. And she used the word girlfriend in a very proprietary way. Not like my friend who's a girl, but my girlfriend, my woman. I said, well, I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to step in the way. I didn't mean for trouble. I just got a text, and I wanted to find out who it was. Well, what'd the text say? And I realized I was about to propose marriage to an angry woman from 718. And I said, will you marry me? Whoa! She was screaming, she was dancing, she was jumping up and down. I said, oh, congratulations, I'm so happy for you. She said, I'm so happy, oh, this is the best. And I realized, marriage, same-sex marriage wasn't yet legal, but I realized that I was a pioneer in proposing same-sex marriage in the state of New York. So they were very happy, but more importantly, all the women at the birthday party felt that I had earned my watercress, and I was so happy that the story sort of buffered the terrible, insulting, despicable present of Crane Stationery. So that's my little story. And unlike what that terrible person who wrote that book about the primates of New York said about Upper East Side women, that we all get cash bonuses for good social climbing or something, and then you get a Birkin bag with which you can bump off other women who only have copies of Birkin bags. It's very ugly. But I feel that if you play your cards right or you're stationary, you can get along on the Upper East Side. And it's not really a blood sport. I don't know how long I've been speaking. That was the main story I wanted to tell you all. Was that enough? Was that? Okay. So all I want to say is thank you for allowing me to fancy myself a storyteller, Sydney. In my house, I get interrupted so often by those damn experiments that I never get to tell a full story from the beginning to the end. So this is kind of a novelty. And if you speak of this one day, just tell them I was thin. Thank you.
Okay, who wants Lisa to come back to the Upper East Side? Lisa, you've got to come back. You can't leave us hanging like this. Great story. So next up is David Litt, and David is the author of Thanks Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years. So this describes what must be the best humor writing job on the planet. He was writing speeches and jokes for President Barack Obama for 8 years. So if you have a chance, I think you should go to YouTube one day and check out that last White House Correspondents' Dinner, and you will see just the most wonderful masterpiece of the form of words and delivery. It's really, really something to see. But anyway, one thing about David Litt is he is just as funny when he's speaking for himself. So please welcome David.
Thank you, and I think you just described me as just as talented as Barack Obama, which I feel like in the political business we would call setting expectations very high. So I'm actually also a New Yorker. I grew up on the Upper West Side, didn't grow up on the West Side, so I have to Google most of the brands that you described when I got home. If you could provide a list later. And I haven't lived here for a while. I actually realized this today, that I'm not really a bona fide New Yorker anymore, because I was crossing the street and there was the blinky don't walk sign, the red sign. And so naturally, I've lived in D.C. for about a decade, so I began to sprint across the street, sure I was about to die. And halfway through, I looked up to see a crowd of New Yorkers staring at me with a mix of like pure calm and also pity, slowly crossing the street. And I just had this moment of like, oh, I guess this is not my primary residence anymore. But the story I'm going to tell tonight is a story that I've, from my book, but also one from, that I've told a little bit with The Moth. I don't know if any of you know that organization. And when I started thinking about telling White House stories, I didn't really want to tell stories about the time I did a particularly good job or, you know, changed American history, partly because I didn't really change American history. But I did have a lot of stories about times I embarrassed myself in front of the president. So that's I'll tell a few of those in rapid succession tonight. And I should say, I did not think I was ever going to be a political person. That was not my plan at all. And then in 2008, I became one of those young people who just wouldn't shut up about Barack Obama. This now feels, you know, given the current situation, something like 1,000 years ago. But at the time, there were a lot of us. And after, I was a senior in college. So after I graduated college, I went to Ohio. I worked on the Obama campaign. After the campaign, I moved to Washington because hope and change. That was the extent of my plan. And then after that, I ended up 2 years later getting a job completely by surprise as a White House speechwriter. They hired me to write speeches. And, you know, I was a little surprised by this, frankly. No one was more surprised by this than me. But people would ask. They would say, well, you must be really good. And I would say, I don't know. I hope so. And this was Washington, so people thought I was being, you know, fake humble. But I was entirely sincere. And the issue was not that I didn't think I had any talent whatsoever. It's just that I knew, you know, there are 323 million people in the United States. And some of them are babies. But a lot of them are adults. And it just seemed to me that it was unlikely that I was the best, you know, we the people could do. So every day I would walk into the White House absolutely certain that someone had made a mistake. And while this was going on, my friends and family were now equally certain that I had direct access to the President of the United States. So like I was sitting in my White House office. I remember this very clearly. I got a text from my sister, and it said, "How come the Department of Homeland Security doesn't have a mailing address?" Which is not a text you want to get from anybody at any time. But if you're in the White House, you want to know the answer to this stuff, and I frankly have no idea. And it's like that with everything. I mean, suddenly I'm 24 years old, everyone has a policy they think only I can get through Congress. Everybody has something wrong with Obamacare they would really like me to know about. And most of all, everybody has a question. Everybody wants to know, have you met him yet? Have you met Obama yet? And I say no, and then I get this look. And it's a look that I soon learn means you may be 24 years old and working at the White House, but you're still a disappointment to your family and friends. And I'm going to be honest here. I understand why people make that mistake, because a lot of people, you know, you think the White House is like the TV show The West Wing, where everyone's hanging out with the president, or it's like the show Scandal, where everyone's having sex with the president. But really, if you're looking for like a good movie TV analogy, the White House is kind of like the Death Star. And what I mean by that is just that it's these full of these big hallways. People are running around. There's thousands of people who work there. And just because, you know, every stormtrooper technically works there doesn't mean that they all get one-on-one time with Darth Vader. That's what I try to explain. I try to explain this Death Star thing, and it doesn't work. I still get that look. And frankly, no one is more disappointed than me. I mean, no one wants me to meet Obama more than I would like me to meet Obama. And there's two reasons for that, and I just want to go into both of them quickly. The first one is corny, but it's kind of true. I came to Washington because I believed that I could make a difference. I didn't know what it was, but I thought there must be something that I can do for my country. And the second reason was I would really like Barack Obama and I to become best friends. And I don't mean to imply that every White House staffer in the Obama years thought they were going to become buddies with the president, but I am absolutely willing to guarantee you that none of us ruled it out. Because you would hear these stories. You know, somebody got a high five or a fist bump in the hallway. Someone got invited up to play cards on Air Force One. And the moral of the story was any moment could be a moment that changes your life forever. So my first chance at a life-changing moment came in November of 2011. I was sitting in my office. I got a call, and the chief speechwriter, his name was Jon Favreau, who some of you may know now from his podcast, he called me up and he said, how would you like to write the Thanksgiving Day address? It's a video address. And I will say right here that I understand that, you know, if the State of the Union is on one side of the presidential speechwriting spectrum, you know, Happy Thanksgiving, America, is all the way on the other side. But as far as I was concerned, these were the most important words Barack Obama would ever say. And so I spent a full week just researching Thanksgiving, which you would think I would know something about. But I just, you know, I went through all the pilgrims, I did my research, I researched my research, I revised my revisions. And then finally, it's the day of the actual videotaping, and I go to the diplomatic room to watch President Obama tape this Thanksgiving video address. And the diplomatic room is one of the most beautiful rooms in the White House. It has this wraparound mural of 18th century American life. And I'm standing there, and I've been told that the thing you have to do when you're in a room like that, you have to act like you've been there before. So I'm standing there, you know, acting like I've been there before. And the woman behind the camera takes one look at me, and she says, is this your first time here? And I just crack immediately. I'm like, yeah, I have never been here before. I need some help. And she tells me not to worry. Her name is Hope Hall. She's the president's videographer, and she's going to take care of everything. All I have to do is wait. So I wait, and I wait. And just when I'm wondering, is this whole thing a practical joke, someone gets a text or an email on their BlackBerry, and they say, okay, he's coming. And then there's kind of a crackling in the air for about 30 seconds, and then President Obama walks through the door, and he's standing up, so we all stand up, and he sits down, so we all sit down, and he looks in the camera, and he's about to start taping, when Hope, the videographer, turns to me and says, Mr. President, this is David. This is actually the first video he's ever written for you. And President Obama looks at me, and he says, oh, how's it going? David. And I remember thinking one thing in that moment, which was, I did not realize we were going to have to answer questions. And I have literally no idea what I said after that. I actually blacked out. Like, I went home that year for Thanksgiving, and my family said, oh, so have you met him yet? And I said, yeah. And they said, what did he say? And I said, how's it going? And they said, what did you say? And I said, I don't know. I blacked out. And I get that disappointed look. And again, you know, nobody's more disappointed than I am about my performance, because if I'm going to be the kind of person who can do something for my country, I feel like I might need to answer some more difficult questions than, how's it going? And there's not really any indication I can do it. But I make a promise to myself. I say, if I ever get another chance, I am not going to let myself down. I'm going to show the president how valuable I am. I'm going to be the kind of person who makes the president of the United States better at his job because I'm in the room. And honestly, I didn't know if I would ever get that second chance, but in fact, I got it just a few weeks later. I got another call from John, the chief speechwriter, and he said, Betty White is turning 90 years old. And NBC is doing this comedy special for her where they're going to have different famous people wish her this happy birthday in these little 30-second skits, and you're pretty funny, and no one else wants to do it. So do you want to give it a shot? And I said, absolutely. And again, I totally understand. State of the Union is over here. Happy birthday, Betty White, is all the way over there. But this is my Gettysburg Address. I mean, this is for real. And so I throw myself into this thing. We have a week to make it perfect. And the first thing that that John and I do is we come up with a good joke for the president to say. So we're going to have him pretend to write a birthday card. And then you'll hear his voice in a voiceover, and he'll say, dear Betty, you're so young and full of life. I can't believe you're turning 90. In fact, I don't believe it. Please send a copy of your long-form birth certificate to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So we feel good about this joke. But then I need to do something that I never imagined was on the description for White House employees. I need to go buy Betty White a birthday card for the president to sign. So there's a CVS about half a block from the White House. I leave my office. I go get a good birthday card. And I'm about to check out at the register when I have this moment of an epiphany. I think, wait a second, we don't just need one birthday card. We need two identical birthday cards because we're going to do two different camera angles. We don't want anyone to see the president's already written down his birthday greeting. I'm thinking, yes, this is what White House staffers are supposed to feel like. I feel like Rob Lowe in the West Wing. I go back and I buy that second birthday card, check out. I bring it back to my office. Now, the last thing we need in order to have everything ready for the day of the taping, we need something for the president to do just to end the video, some way out. And so I come up with this idea. At the time, and this was the olden days, so the president had his iPod, and no one had ever seen him listen to music on his iPod. So I think he'll put in some headphones, and we'll watch him listen to The Golden Girls, which is Betty White's, you know, that's the theme song from Betty White's most popular show. And so I find the perfect pair of headphones. They fit over the ears. They're going to look great on camera. I listen to the Golden Girls theme song on repeat for a week just to get in the mood. And then finally, it's the day of the taping. And so I get a call. It's a Friday. And they say, all right, come on over to the West Wing. Now, here's what no one told me about having a meeting in the Oval Office. When you have a meeting in the Oval Office, you don't just walk into the Oval Office. The first thing you do, you wait in this little windowless chamber. It's kind of like a doctor's waiting room, except instead of Marie Claire magazine, it has priceless pieces of American art. And instead of there's a receptionist, there's a man with a gun who, in a worst-case scenario, is legally obligated to kill you. So it turns out this little room is the perfect place to second-guess every life choice you have ever made. And so I'm sitting there just thinking, okay, do I remember how to explain this joke to the president? You know, do I have both of the birthday cards? Are my headphones still in the pocket? Are my headphones still in my pocket? I am on the verge of a nervous breakdown. It's just me and Hope Hall, the videographer, and I don't know if I'm going to last another second when finally one of the president's personal aides comes out and says, all right, he's ready for you. Head on in. Now, I would like to claim a little bit of credit here. The first time I ever walked into the Oval Office, I did not black out. Thank you. But I remember this moment very clearly. The president was sitting behind the desk, you know, that big resolute desk. And then just behind me, out of the corner of my eye, I could see the Emancipation Proclamation. Not like a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation, the Emancipation Proclamation. And I can feel the message this document is sending through the room. And that message is, I'm here because I freed the slaves. What are you doing here? And I look across the desk at the president, and he is also wondering what I'm doing here. But I actually feel really good. I've spent a whole week just preparing for this one moment. And so I look across the president, and I've been rehearsing just how to explain this joke to him. And I open my mouth, and what comes out is kind of like I'm trying to ask for directions, but in Spanish. Like, the nouns and the verbs are there, but there's nothing in between them. I just say, Betty White, video, 90 years old, birthday card, ¿está bien? And President Obama gives me kind of a look. And Hope, the videographer, she rescues me and explains the joke. But I'm not feeling great because, you know, I'm here to show the president how professional I am. And in my professional opinion, we're not off to a very good start. However, I'm not that worried because I do have this second birthday card that I thought to buy at the CVS. And so this is the moment I am going to show the president just how invaluable I am to the Obama administration. And so the moment we're done with this first camera angle, I walk up to the desk at the Oval, and I pull out the card, and I say, Mr. President, I'm going to need to take that card from you and replace it with this identical card because we don't want anyone to know you've already written your birthday greeting. And President Obama looks up at me, and he says, so we're going to film from all the way over there? And I say, yeah, that's right. And he says, so no one's going to be able to see inside the card. And I say, yeah, that's right. And he says, so I can just pretend to write in this card? I don't actually need a second birthday card? And I say, yeah. That's right. And I put the card back in my pocket and realize this is strike two. But I'm not ready to give up yet, because I made this promise to myself. If I had my chance, I was not going to let myself down. And so the moment we're done with this card, I still have the bit with the headphones. I know that that's pretty good. That was my idea. So I work up every last bit of courage I can muster, and I reach into my pocket, and what I pull out is a hairball made out of wires. I mean, I don't exactly know what happened, but somewhere in the waiting room, I have just tangled these headphones. It's completely hopeless. And now I don't know what to do with the whole mess, so I just hand it to the President of the United States. Now, in the Obama White House, we often heard a phrase, there is no commodity on earth more valuable than a president's time. Which, frankly, I thought was a cliche. Until I watched Barack Obama untangle headphones for about 30 seconds while looking directly at me. And so he untangles and he untangles, and finally he finishes, and he just looks at Hope, and he goes, shoddy advance work. In this way, I know, in this way where he was letting you know that, you know, A, he was just joking, and also, B, he was not even a tiny bit joking. And I have to be honest with you, in that moment, I mean, my heart just sinks. Because, you know, this was my second chance to make a good first impression on the president, and I failed. And I barely can even hear what's going on. I'm kind of, it's an out-of-body experience. As President Obama says something like, you know, well, should I bob my head in time to the music? Would that be funnier? And I sort of say, yeah, but my heart isn't in it. All I want to do is just get out of the Oval Office. I know that I have blown my chance. And President Obama looks into the camera to film this final little scene. And then he stops. And he says, well, hang on. If I'm going to bob my head in time to the music, I need to know how the music goes. Does anyone here know the Golden Girls theme song? And so President Obama looks at Hope, the videographer, and Hope doesn't say anything. And so I look at Hope, and Hope doesn't say anything. So President Obama looks at me. And suddenly, I know exactly what I can do for my country. And so I'm standing in the Oval Office, with the Emancipation Proclamation right behind me, and I look our commander-in-chief right in the eye, and I say, bum, 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 thank you for being a friend, bum, 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 travel down the road and back again. Something, something, you're a pal and a confidant. But then he kind of looks into it, so I keep going. I'm like, and if you threw a party. And that's when he gives me a look that's like, okay, president's time. But I have to say it works. President Obama bobs his head in time to the music, and we get our video, and Betty White gets her birthday card. And I leave the Oval Office for my first ever Oval Office meeting knowing that the President of the United States was better at his job because I was in the room. And after that, you know, whenever I talk to my friends or my family, I still get that same question. They still say, have you met him yet? Have you met Obama yet? And I can finally say, actually, yeah, I have. And then just to myself, I think, not to brag or anything, but technically, I'm thankful he's a friend. Thanks.
Thank you, David. Those were the days, right? Next, we have Annabelle Gurwitch. And, you know, we would love Annabelle if she only wrote book titles alone. Listen to this. I see you made an effort about growing older. Wherever you go, there they are, tackling her family. You're very brave, Annabelle, I have to say. And her new solo show is titled, If You Lived With Me, You'd Be Home By Now. So she is an actress, a comedian, a documentary filmmaker, a teacher, a storyteller. Annabelle does it all. So please welcome her.
Oh, thank you. You know, the one thing I'm not anymore is a New Yorker. And I lived in New York. And the funny thing is, I went to NYU, and when I got to New York, I fell in love with New York like nobody else. My entire goal in life was to be listed in the New York phone book. I thought you had to do something really great to be listed in that. Of course, now that goal just, you can't even achieve that anymore. It's just very sad. But the funny thing is when I went to NYU, I thought that New York ended at 14th Street. I didn't even know there was an Upper East Side. It took me 5 years to go above 14th Street. So this is all a surprise for me, really. You know I'm billed as a humorist, but I like to think of myself as someone who writes polemics, because there's really no person, no place or thing or idea that I haven't had an argument with, really. I think I'm always just writing arguments. And this particular story that I want to tell tonight is from my book, I See You Made an Effort, which was my railing against aging. And I wrote that book as I was, I can only say this with laughter, about to turn 50. Oh, those days behind me now. It seems like a lifetime ago. But at the time, I was really upset about this phrase that I kept hearing. It was, you know, 50 is the new 40. And I just thought, well, that's not true. Because when you're 50, no one who's 40 thinks you're the same age as them. That's just a crock of, you know. And so I was really, you know, railing against this idea. And I wrote this book with the idea in mind of saying, you know, why can't we just be the age that we actually are? And this particular story, though, takes place in Los Angeles. And it's a story about show business. And, you know, in show business, David, as you said about politics, in any moment, your entire life can change or not. And so on this particular day, I'm at a callback for a TV commercial. Earlier that week, I had attended a casting call to play a real to slightly character-looking, approachable, believable mother. Now, and I think, well, I've got this one in the bag. Real to slightly character usually means might be Jewish. I have given birth, and if I get my hormone cocktail calibrated just right, I am capable of appearing approachable, particularly if someone is paying me money. And we are told by the casting director that the director and the ad agency executives will be in the audition room. We are to speak our names into the camera, and the director will point to us, and he'll either say yes or no. And if it's no, we are instructed to leave the room. Four actresses and I walk into the room together. And I am the first one to say my name. Smiles frozen on our faces. We hold our breath as a director makes his pronouncement. No, 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 yes. We three who have been given the nose wobble out on our wobbly legs when someone emerges from the room and he strides past a group of defeated-looking paunchy men with receding hairlines who are all wearing bathrobes. They're here for the husband role. Annabelle, it's Dan from New York. Oh, Dan, hi. Dan is a producer that I have worked with a number of times, but I hadn't recognized him. Oh, I'm sorry, Annabelle, that's just how the director is. Oh, no problem, I say, trying to appear unaffected. You know, we're also looking for villagers. Oh, you mean like it takes a village? Villagers? Like a group of mothers? No, you see, our story takes place back in time into the Middle Ages, where we need marauding villagers. Well, I can maraud. Wait, you see, Annabelle, we need people who look unkempt, disheveled. You know, the Middle Ages were very tough on people. But Dan, I tell him, this isn't what I normally look like. No, I made an effort. Marauding villager, that's my normal. Well, I'll see what I can do, Dan says. And later he emails me with the information that they haven't cast all these villagers. And can I send a photo? And I do. And I wake up the next day to the news that I have been chosen to maraud. And I show up at the wardrobe fitting, and I am laced into a beautiful celadon velvet bodice. The wardrobe mistress stands in front of me and scowls, and she immediately covers it over with a shapeless cotton peasant blouse. She drapes that over with a rough woolen tunic, and then she wraps me in a knitted shawl. I have never felt so ancient in my entire life. My grandmother would weep. I look exactly like my potato farming ancestors from the Ukraine. We are to shoot in that evening on the European Street on the back lot of Universal Studios. And it's exciting to pull up to the historic medieval town. The buildings have stained glass windows and low tiled roofs and thatched roofs. And, oh, it looks so realistic, even if it is only stucco facades. I intend to maraud like there's no tomorrow. The entire area is swarming with crew members and a large cast of background performers. A tall, rail-thin man with a pointy felt dunce cap resting on his skull strolls by, and he tips his cap in my direction. His skeletal frame and impossibly long limbs give him the appearance of a medieval arthropod. I spot a stooped and wrinkled creature who appears to have gone through extensive special effect makeup. He has impossibly sunken cheeks and long tendrils of greasy hair emerging from his otherwise bald head. I am about to compliment him when he smiles at me and I see that he has no teeth. And he is actually heading into the makeup trailer. I follow him in, sure that they will need to devote a tremendous amount of time to aging me up. And a makeup artist assesses me. She flattens my hair to my head with a hard pound of the heel of her hand and says, "Next." Stunned. I'm heading out when I hear "you" called in my direction. The lead artist points to me. "You, go wash your face. You've got mascara on. That looks too modern." And I say, "Okay," and I'm noting mentally that the villager sitting next to me is wearing iridescent blue eyeshadow. "I've got my eye on you," she says as I leave the trailer. The sky darkens, and our group, we're assembled where the first shot of the night is being set up on a cobblestone street that's been sprayed with water. The assistant director places "we few, we happy few, we band of villagers" on the street. Grasshopper and Old Toothless aren't principals, but they get prime spots in the front of the pack, and I'm not surprised. These guys look fossilized. "Okay," we are told, "there's a giant green troll chasing you through the street. The troll will be CGI'd in post-production later. Who wants to carry a torch?" "A lit torch?" "Yeah, like on fire torch?" "Yeah, oh me, I want to do that." And just like that, a prop guy dips a heavy wooden club wrapped in gauze into a bucket of kerosene. He hands it to me and lights it with a blowtorch. No one has asked, "Have any suicidal ideation? Any anger management issues? How well do you balance running on cobblestones? How about wondering what kind of person jumps at a chance to run with a lit torch?" "Is there anything we should know about these torches?" "Oh, we're going to do fire training," he says. But as he steps back into the shadows, the shot is called "Action! Villagers with torches run towards the troll." And a mob of 24 peasants rushes forward, jostling for position. Each one of us principals knows that if you're not recognized on camera, you will not earn residuals. Each one of the background people knows that if they are recognizable, they will have a shot at being upgraded to principal. And it's clear that no one in charge cares about which of us are seen. I'm just trying not to slip and fall. "Bait the troll with your torches." Villagers are thrusting their torches at this imaginary monster. "Now turn around and run." As I pivot, something hot brushes the skin on the back of my neck. "You," he points to a background person who's standing next to me. "I love your enthusiasm, lady, but try not to get so close to her head." And I know he means mine, and that is the extent of our fire training. And each time they do the shot, the director adds and subtracts serfs from a seemingly endless supply from a background tent. "Wait, hold the shot. Did you put mascara on?" The makeup person shouts above the chaos. A woman standing next to me is wearing frosted coral lipstick. Another has visibly feathered bangs, but something about me just irks her. "I actually did put mascara on." No, I didn't," I say. She strides over, swabs dirt on my face, and then pulls a wimple, pushes it down over my hair, low down on my forehead, and retreats to the side. And I ask one of the assistant directors if he thinks it's going to be a continuity problem because I'm wearing a wimple now because I've been established without a wimple. And he just explodes into peals of laughter. "Oh, you're all like this big in the frame, this big." And after that shot, the production team begins preparation for another part of the street, for another shot, and only background actors are used in the next setups. And several hours pass, and I'm adrift, grazing at the craft services table on salty chips and nuts. I'm just so bored. And at 1 a.m., three of us principals ask the assistant director if we are needed, and he just stares at us. As if we've asked if he believes that the Large Hadron Collider will one day produce a black hole. We'll call you when we need you. Uh-oh, I think. There are a lot of us, villagers. They can save money by only using the background villagers. And it hits me that we all fall, all of us women, into two categories. Maidens and crones. There is nothing in between. In fact, as the median lifespan of a female serf during the Middle Ages was 43, I am actually too old for this job. And I feel very grateful to be there. And I feel more determined than ever to maraud. By 4 a.m., there's only 1 hour left before sunrise. Wrapped in a blanket, I head out of my trailer to find the production. The set decorators are dressing a town square with fresh bales of hay. I sidle up to a portable heater by the director, and I drop my blanket to remind him that I am an actor and not one of the dozens of crew people. Now, a crew person in a wimple would be unusual, but the clock is ticking, and I cannot take a chance, and I am chosen for the last shot. I am standing in the town square, arms laden with baskets of bread, when a giant troll bursts through a wall. Bricks tumble down, and I am running for my life. My heart is beating quickly. My eyes dart back and forth, searching for a safe route. I hurry to escape being crushed by that troll. As I sprint, my velvet bodice bursts open. I have snacked on too many salty craft service, but covered as it is with a tunic and a shawl, no one notices or cares. And I feel surprisingly, wonderfully unburdened by the desire to look good. I am free to let my mouth hang open. Drool is running down the side of my cheek as I lope along. The sun begins to rise, and in the distance, I hear the director call, "Cut, that's a wrap." The air is clear as I drive home. I have survived the night without my head catching on fire. And I fall asleep dreaming about all the dough that I'm going to make when that commercial runs. That commercial never ran. But somewhere, maybe in some vault or desk drawer or on some file on some computer, there's digital footage of a commercial set in a medieval village. And if you look very closely, there's a woman being chased by a troll. She is a lumpen sack, a babushka wearing a babushka. She's an infinitesimal pixel scurrying across the old world town square, gorgeously lit by the full moon and millions of Klieg lights. And you'll be shaking your head, wondering, how could they spend so much money and never air this spot? But what you won't be wondering is, why is that crone wearing mascara? That's my story for you.
Thank you. I think you've got about 75 people who are going to be watching for that commercial every single day. We'll know you by your mascara. So next up we have Maeve Higgins. And Maeve, you know, is not from around here. And lucky for us, her book is titled Maeve in America, Essays by a Girl from Somewhere Else. Now, Maeve is an Irish comic and writer. That somewhere else is Ireland. And, you know, she brings us an update on that famous Irish storytelling tradition. And, of course, what we're wondering is, can you leave home and like it? And hope you'll shed a little light on that, Maeve. Welcome, Maeve.
Hi. Oh, thank you. This is such a fun event. Hi. Hi, hi. I have to often start by trying to convince everybody, lately anyway, that like Irish people, we're not magic. Because people, I don't know, they think we're magic. I don't know if you think I'm magic, but, you know, we're open to, yeah. Like, basically, our president at the moment is this tiny little man, and by profession, do you know what his profession is? A poet. Like, yeah, so it's a very different background to our American president. I mean, that's what he did as a job. He was a poet. He's tiny. He's got these tiny little glasses. And he, you know, he writes poetry for, I don't know if it's like money per se, but like maybe little gold coins or I don't know. And I meet people, I get really mad if someone cuts me in line, and then and my accent gets stronger. I was going to order a salad. They say, oh, that's so cute. What are you saying? That is adorable. So nobody takes me seriously, I think, because of my strong Irish accent. But I'm going to read you something, and then the way I do it is, you know, read and stop and keep go. You know, you know how reading goes. Works, you know how reading works. This is one of the earlier pieces that I wrote for the New York Times before I was contracted, when I had to always, you know, pitch to them kind of desperately, hey, I've got an interesting take. But this one actually worked for me. I think because they've got, well, you'll see. By the way, I moved here almost 6 years ago, so I'm well used to it now. You know, I started off being one of those hopeful New Yorkers where I was like, you know, I actually love the subway. It's so democratic down there. And now I hate it. I would do anything not to go down there. I use these unethical car services whenever I can. Hate the subway so much. Makes me so stressed out. Did you used to use the subway before you were okay, rich? But the subway is like, You know what it is. Do you remember what it is? You've seen it on TV and everything. Okay. The subway runs underneath the city, large parts of the city, mainly the parts that don't actually need it, but that's a different thing. And the subway is basically like so stressful. I've seen a four-year-old miss the G train, and like I just saw his eyes over the top of the window of the subway door, and he was so furious. He aged like 40 years, and he was like, oh, and I was thinking, like, you're four, why are you mad? What were you going to do? I was like, I was going to fire my immigrant nanny. You know, I don't know what he was so late for, but he was enraged, and he, you know, threw his sippy cup down, and black coffee spilled out everywhere, but I'm getting more and more used to the subway. I mean, one of my earlier trips, I got on the train and there was an empty seat, and the guy, I went to sit down, but of course a seat is always empty for a reason. And this particular reason, you know, he said to me, there's piss on the seat, you know, it's a charming man, there's piss on the seat. And I said, oh, thank you, you know. Oh, and I tried to talk to him, but he had those headphones, you know, the headphones that you don't really see. You know, the wireless ones. I've often started many a conversation. I think it's going very well. They're smiling and they're nodding, and then I see, oh, they're wearing, okay. And I said, you know, thanks for letting me know. I appreciate it. You're so community-minded, you know, it's really great. And he said, oh, well, you know, I feel obligated. Some guy told me back and forth at night that he was annoyed that he had to be kind, which I think is the real New York trait. And then as, you know, as he would warn everybody when they tried to sit down, and then when he was getting off the train, he said to me, it's your turn. So then I was in charge of warning people. But I have this voice, so people weren't really listening, so they would make a beeline for the seat, and I, you know, I would say, sorry, excuse me, you can't, there's piddle there. And nobody knew what I was saying. So in the end, I wrote in my notebook, you know, do not sit. And then I tore out the page and I floated that in the puddle. So it was much more visible. And then this one lady was like, oh, you're not going to write that in Spanish? And I was like, so, all right. So, okay, let me tell you this. Okay. This is from, in January 2014, a girl from Cove in Ireland, Cove is formerly known as Queenstown, journeyed across the Atlantic and skipped rosy-cheeked off an airplane at Kennedy International Airport to start her new life. That was me. And I was rosy-cheeked because I wear this blush, the shade is orgasm. Do you know that one? It's aspirational. In January 1892, a girl from Queenstown, which is now known as Cove, skipped rosy-cheeked off a boat at Ellis Island to start her new life. And bless you. And that was Annie Moore. Do you know who Annie Moore is? Have you ever heard of Annie Moore? You have? Who was it? Yeah, she was on a boat. Yeah, you know? First immigrant through Ellis Island. Exactly, yes. She was the first immigrant through Ellis Island, and she left from my hometown, you know, 100 and... I shouldn't do math on stage. 40 years ago. No, 1892. When was that? It's like 127 years ago or something. Is there any abacuses in? Whatever it was. And I know that she was rosy-cheeked because the New York Times reported on that. It said that she was blushing because of the attention. So when she arrived on the island, there was a big sort of pomp and ceremony. She was given $10 in a silver coin. And she was with her two little brothers. So she was 17, and she had her two little brothers with her. So she was really an unaccompanied minor. She was undocumented, which is kind of wrong to say, because in those days you didn't need documents. You could just come in if you were white, as long as you weren't Chinese, because they were banned at the time. But maybe she wasn't mortified by the attention. Maybe the redness was simply caused by the icy wind whipping through the harbor. Or maybe she was just lit up with the anticipation of seeing her parents for the first time in years, and the relief of no longer being her little brother's sole guardian as she had been on their voyage. I have no idea. I grew up knowing all about the people that left my hometown, but nothing about what happened next. So over 2 million people actually left from my hometown of Cove over like the worst years of the Irish, you know, of Irish history. You know the history, I mean. It's over. We're fine now. Everyone's very full. In fact, if anything, we're chubby. But there was a famine. There was a famine, but we're okay now. Cove was also the last place that Titanic stopped. I don't know. Do you know the end? Do you know what happened to Titanic? He's making a face like, yes, I do. Okay, we won't spoil the end of that movie for them. You should watch it. It's so romantic. While the other children in the country went to amusement parks, our school trips were to replicas of coffin ships, so named because of the death rate on board as they transported people to America during the Irish famine. My classmates and I filed into the wooden bowels of a ship to listen to audio of people groaning and and look at wax figures leaning over buckets. So you see, this whole leaving thing, it's in me. I came here on an O-1 visa, so an O-1, it's the technical term, and another way of, it's also called an alien of extraordinary ability, fellows, ladies, anyone? No, that ability is doing comedy, persuading friends who do voiceovers in cartoons to write letters to the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services vouching for me. As I told you, Annie was an unaccompanied minor. She didn't have documents and she sailed right in. I think about her and me and the people who were simply born here and the people who die trying to get here and the people who have lived here since childhood, who are American in every way except for paperwork, but they don't have a path to citizenship. I mean the sheer dumb luck involved in it all. So you can follow Annie's story. She actually lived her whole life in America, just a couple of miles away from Ellis Island. She went to the Lower East Side and she met up with her parents, and her and her brothers lived with parents. And then she married a baker. Heaven. So isn't that such a good plan? Like, I guess, you know, whatever, everyone talks about dating in New York, but like, my friends are more like, I want somebody who's like woke. You know, I want somebody who's like financially stable, but no one is like, I really want a baker, like cakes. Can you imagine? Just cakes all the time. I think she was so right on to do that. Herself and her German baker had 10 children, but only 5 made it through to adulthood. Can you even imagine burying 5 children like that? I can't. I tuck it away in the part of me that says, she must have been different from us, with fewer feelings. That's the delusional folder that I keep. It's full of current stories from far off places that are too sad to bear. Annie died when she was 50 years old. Family lore says her coffin was too wide to fit down the narrow stairs of the tenement house. Those cakes. And it had to be hoisted out the window. Yeah. Not to boast, but I also gained weight when I moved to New York. In fact, I was down by, what's that building called? You know, it's like, looks like it'd be the Hatch or something? Or like, you know, it's like the new, it's very controversial, like $1 billion. The Vessel, yeah. And I was taking a selfie by the Vessel for political reasons. No, because it's funny. To put, if you take the right selfie, you can have your face in all of the... Anyway, so I was taking a selfie, and a guy, I guess, thought I was taking a photo of him, and he yelled at me, and he said, don't you fucking take a picture of me, you fat whore. And I was so... And I should say, he said it in a way that was like, those are bad things. I don't know if I'm doing the tone right. Like, he wasn't like, ooh, value for money. He was like, those are two bad things. You're both of those bad things. And, you know, I was taken aback, I'm sure, as were you, because he didn't say sex worker. And also, you know, calling somebody fat, like, that's not cool. That's just your opinion, you know. That's what I would say to him if he didn't run off. That's just one guy's opinion, and my doctor's opinion, and my nutritionist's opinion. That's just three guys' opinions. And also, I was like basically at war with my body for my entire 20s, and then I melted down all those weapons of war. I poured them all over nachos, and I'm so happy now. So I didn't worry about that. And then the whore thing, you know, like... again, like self-esteem stuff, but I would be really bad at that, I think, because, you know, I have back problems come and go. But also, I feel like, and you know, you don't get to choose. You have to be like, oh, no problem, absolute, you know. So that would be an issue for me. And also, the pricing of it, like, I feel like, you know, what, $5? I don't know, $5? And then the Irish person in me would definitely come out. I'd be like, no, put your wallet away, put it away. I will get this one, you get the next one. You know, well, we're in your car. So there's that. On Thanksgiving, I went for a wander around Annie's old neighborhood. I peeped into St. Mary's, the local church founded by Irish immigrants. Maybe you know St. Mary's was rebuilt after being burned down by anti-Catholic nativists back in the 1830s. By the time Annie arrived, the Irish had a surer footing in the city's political and social life. The Irish were clannish, looking out for their own. I've got mixed feelings about this. I'm glad that they made it, but I'm sorry that they often stood on the backs of other marginalised communities to do that. So what else has happened in the 125 years? That's how much it was. Since Annie Moore, but this is a couple of years, so this is whatever, 127, okay, it doesn't matter. Was anyone around then? No, I'm just kidding. You were there. You're like, well, I was four. I don't really remember. What else has happened in that time? Well, the ban on Chinese immigrants has been lifted, but the ban on Muslim immigrants has been instated. Catholic churches are no longer being set alight by nativists, but synagogues and mosques are being attacked by people on the same tip. A man whose own mother walked through the same Ellis Island doors as Annie campaigned for the presidency by slamming immigrants at every turn, and he won, and we know how that's turning out. We're hearing echoes so loud that they've become the sound of today. I went home for the holidays. I still call Ireland home, which if those of you who are immigrants, you'll know it's confusing, isn't it? Because they feel like, well, here is also my home, but I still say I'm going home. I stood on the darkening quayside in Cove on Christmas Eve, and we have a statue of Annie there. There's a corresponding statue of her here on Ellis Island, but there's a statue of her leaving there. She seems small and capable. Her hands are lightly resting on her little brother's shoulders, and she's not looking out to sea. She's looking back at Ireland, at a country that she would never see again. On my flight home to New York after Christmas, I imagined meeting Annie today. I'd make her a pot of tea, I'd give her some cakes, and I'd tell her how her family turned out so far. She never made it out of the city, but her descendants are spread across the country. They're actors, they're doctors, they're financial consultants, they're stay-at-home parents, with Jewish, Latin, and Asian blood mixed in with her own. Annie Moore never made a fortune, she never wrote a book, she never invented a computer. And why should she? Why should immigrants be deemed extraordinary to deserve a place at the table? She did enough. She was just one woman who lived a short life and a hard one. And she lives on today, not just in her descendants. She lives on in every girl arriving from a country shot through with rebellion, with hunger, and in every immigrant that gives America their humanity. So that's my piece. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for very nice. Thank you.
That reminds me of one of those stories that should be set to music, like an old Joan Baez song or something. You know. Anyway, we are going to close out the show with Chip Kidd. And Chip is very famous for his book jacket designs. But really, I think we need a special category for Chip because he's super special. He's really one of a kind. He is a graphic designer who actually likes words. Yes. And he writes books, novels, and nonfiction. He creates graphic books about Batman. His TED Talks are phenomenal. Check them out if you have a chance. And to top it all off, he's one of the most engaging storytellers around. So he says he's going to try something new tonight for us. So you've been warned. Hang on. Welcome, Chip.
People who eat people are the loneliest people in the world. All right, so the first thing is to tell you about my new mantra and how I acquired it. My old mantra, I had just worn out. Okay, my old mantra was, oh my God, this is a fucking nightmare. And you say that enough, and it gets old. So, but I'm thinking, I'm like Dolly Levi. I'm like, send me a sign for my new mantra. And so one day, I was standing in line at the KFC off of Union Square. I was a couple people back from the counter. And there's this skinny little guy at the front ordering. And he says, okay, I'd like 3 buckets of 21-piece original recipe chicken. And the woman behind the counter says, is that for here or to go? Now, this guy was clearly there alone. And he just snaps and he says, excuse me, how the hell am I gonna sit here and eat 3 buckets of 21-piece original recipe chicken by myself? And she looks at him and she says, bitch, I don't know your life. Thank you. Thank you. Try it. Not now, but, you know, try it with your friends or your family or the police. It works. So it never ceases to amaze me when I actually do get recognized in public. It's mainly due to the TED Talks at this point, but I was in the subway, the other day, and this lovely young woman sort of like comes up to me and she says, "Pardon me, but I'm a graphic design student at Parsons, and you look an awful lot like Chip Kidd." And I was just about to respond when she said, no offense. And I said, yeah, I get that all the time. But what I was thinking was, bitch, you don't know my life. Okay, so I have this wonderful friend, Juanita, and she had a child. She had a son, and she named him Jose. And then, after a time, she had another son, and she named him Jose B. All right, now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, oh my God, that is so racist. Pero no. No el es racismo. Juanita es mi amiga buena. Y todos solamente amor con nosotros. Es el verdad. So, I'm developing a TV series for ABC, and here's the elevator pitch. It's sort of like This Is Us, except it's called This Is Me, and it's about me, and the actors are height and weight appropriate. So the first season is about my search for a housekeeper for my apartment. And by episode 4, I found her, and it's Juanita. And but by the end of the season, after some strenuous dusting, She knocks over one of my vintage Batman figures, and its arm falls off. And so it's a cliffhanger. Now, Juanita is played by Jennifer Lopez, who is darling. And boy, can she clean. Well, all right. No, wait. Her step double can clean. It's amazing. There's no dust anywhere. She squeegees the fake windows. Now, the stunt double is played by Ariana Grande, who's fantastic. And during a rehearsal, I pulled her aside and I said, hey, would you actually like to clean for me in real life? And she said, well, she told me to do something that was actually physically impossible. And that's fine. Now, one of the subplots is my character, who is played by Charlie Sheen, casting coup, gets loaded all the time and is constantly hitting on Juanita's boyfriend, Carlos, who is played by Alex Rodriguez. And so, Carlos has to decide whether he's going to have my legs broken and have Jose and Hose B be on the lookout. And so there you have it. It's a dramedy. This is me. So I've also been working on my memoirs, which, and the working title is Sometimes the Floor Seems Like Home. And my editor's like, wow, that title's really a downer. And I said, well, bitch, you don't know my life. Vegans are very special people. The most pretentious people in the world. All right, so as the lovely introduction said, whatever reputation I have was built upon, of all things, designing book jackets. And it's been very odd. And 2 days ago, I just passed my 33rd year at Alfred A. Knopf as a book jacket designer. And so it's very odd to be known as a famous book jacket designer. It's like being a famous plumber. But some time ago, the Knopf publicity department was contacted by CBS Sunday Morning, which wanted to do a feature on our art department. So everybody was very excited about this. And, you know, about 2 weeks later, I find myself in my little 10 by 12 office, and sitting on the other side of my desk is none other than Leslie Stahl. And I'm a bit nervous. There's the lights and the camera, and you know, but okay, we're gonna do the interview, and I am ready. And so she says, "So, why do books need jackets?" And that threw me. Because I kind of thought that was self-evident. Like, isn't that why you're here? Anyway, I said, well, I think a text or a story needs to have a face. But why? Well, because it needs to look like something. But why?
Why? Because it's important for this text to have a unique visual identity. But why? Because that's my job, to give the book a look, a representational metaphor, an icon. But why? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why books need jackets. I'm obviously living a lie. There's no reason for books to have jackets. Oh, you've broken me, Leslie Stahl. You've broken me. Leslie Stahl, with your small pinched mouth and your accusing slits for eyes. But I need my job, Leslie Stahl. I need my job. It's the only way I can afford to pay Juanita. But who's Juanita? She's the woman who cleans my apartment. But why? So we can put Jose and Hose B through Dalton. Needless to say, the piece never ran. So I live in the neighborhood. I'm just scarce 10 blocks away on the wrong side of the tracks. And I've lived here for 25 years. And I read about there was a new restaurant in town. And it had opened and it got a good review. And I thought, okay, I'll go and I'll try it. And so I sat at the bar. And the waiter came up to me, and I assume he was the waiter, even though he was 12. Everyone is 12. So he says, "Hi, my name is Sebastian, and I'm going to be your server this evening. And I'm so looking forward to working with you. I see you have a drink, but I wanted to know if you had any allergies." And I said, "Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I do, Sebastian. I'm so glad that you asked. I have allergies. Pork tartare. Chicken sushi. Sheep's placenta. Rat sorbet, toe cheese, saccharin, human waste, naked wildebeest, kale, the tears of the oppressed." Oh, no, wait, no, I like those. I actually like that because I love the salt. Love the salt. God, it's so delicious. The hell with my cardiologist and that whole Titus Aronticus thing, that's so decadent. Anyway, doggy bags, cat's paw, cow pies, sheep dip, pig's butt, lark's tongue, rabbit's foot, dick sneeze. Monkey bread, monkey brains, monkey shines, monkey bars, monkey see, monkey do, anything with monkeys. Frankly, your man bun. And your nose ring, which forces me to consider the inside of your nose, which I do not want to do while I am consuming food. My paunch, everyone's complicity. any lubricant that has flavoring. City bike. City bike stations everywhere where cars could be parking. City bike fatalities. Sauerkraut. Certain kinds of cucumbers. I think you know the ones I'm talking about. Cancer, vaginas, earthworms, my mother's breast milk, kryptonite, hangnails, urinal cakes, well, most of them, TV commercials for erectile dysfunction that feature people that you would never, ever want to think about, much less watch having sex. Lynyrd Skynyrd performing anything. Bubble tea with 50 grams of sugar and tapioca the size of golf balls, nutmeg. Impoverished Muppets. An interview with Larry King. The food in Coach. Why am I in Coach? Kale. Val Kilmer is Batman. George Clooney is Batman with nipples. People in front of me on the sidewalk walking slower than I am. Ed Sheeran, a fat British slob who's a billionaire based on three well-placed musical notes. Three! I'm in love with your body. Frankly, if my bed sheets ever smelled like another person, I would stop seeing that person and call the dry cleaner. Therapy ponies. Kanye West, compared to whom Ed Sheeran is Beethoven. Kanye West creates noise pieces that sound like cascades of enormous monoliths of Louis Vuitton luggage tumbling down endlessly the escalator steps at Bergdorf Men's while he loudly frets into the microphone about how all of this will affect his image. That episode of I Love Lucy where she gets the vase stuck on her head over her eyes and can't get it off and Ethel has to take her on the subway and they get separated and Lucy can't see, that is totally anxiety producing. Most root vegetables. Tinsley Mortimer. And the stain she leaves behind wherever she sits. Attempting to purchase Greenland. Attempting to trade Puerto Rico for Greenland. Greenland, which isn't even green. It's covered with ice and snow, and when that melts, dirt. The lotto. All you need is a dollar and a dream to lose both, Sebastian. Casinos. People at casinos, confined to wheelchairs and hooked up to oxygen tanks, who have holes drilled into their throats into which they can insert a burning cigarette and mainline the smoke while they play the slots, which aren't even slots anymore. They're just boopy computers. And these people thus die and live at the same time, not seeming to distinguish which is which. Lawyers who advertise. The staff at Goyard, who made me wait out in the street, outside of the store during business hours for 10 minutes in March, for all for the privilege of spending the equivalent of the gross national product of Guatemala on a bag. He? She? No, it's a they. Trans fat. Pop-up ads, Bitcoin, the hip, the hip dippy hoppy, the hip dippy hoppy, you don't stop the rocking till the damn jam's cooking, the big wigs are booking and the glam slam's working the beat, Sebastian. That's the Sugar Hill Gang, back when rap was good, like with Blondie and the Pet Shop Boys. Starches, the ending of The Sopranos, when the whole damn TV screen just went blank for what seemed like an eternity and no one knew what was going on and there was no explanation. It was like the terror was won. A cockroach. A giant one, Sebastian. I came home one night last week, and I could see something in the moonlight, and I wondered, why is there a football on the floor? So I turned on the lights, and the back of the football suddenly split down the middle, and wings started to sprout out of it. And I reached for a badminton racket, and I swung, and I was only partially successful, and I cleaved it in two. And each of the halves split and sprouted new heads and ran in opposite directions, behind the refrigerator and behind the dishwasher. But I just know they are harvesting bodies there, building an army that will eventually take over the co-op board. And I live on the Upper East Side, Sebastian. And lactose. Okay, you ready to order? People who eat people are the most likely to get a book deal, people in the world. Thanks.
What did I tell you? Were they hilarious? Please give everybody a big hand. Thank you, guys. I think we still have a little food, a little wine. Do we have a few minutes, Carolyn?